Robert Fitz, welcome back to the Bookshelf Conversations.
Hi, Ron. It's a pleasure to be here.
As we were chatting just before we started, this is about a year since I was in Japan and had a chance to go to the Tokyo Dome. Didn't have a chance to see the games that were starting the Major League Baseball season, but you've been at this interest of Japanese baseball for a long time. What got you interested in Japanese baseball in the first place?
Well, I've been big fan of Japanese baseball for about 30 years. In 1993, my wife was transferred to Tokyo, and I kind of went along for the ride. She got there a couple weeks before I did, and when I arrived, my first night there after a 14-hour long flight with pretty much no sleep, completely jet lagged, I get in the hotel room, and she says, "Hurry up, we've got baseball tickets."
What a
You know, who's
great wife.
complaining, right? So, I get ready, we go out, and I had never seen a baseball game like I saw that night. Japanese baseball is completely different from American baseball. The fans are so into it. The atmosphere is always like, excuse me just a second. The atmosphere in a Japanese regular season game is kind of like a playoff atmosphere. In the United States, the fans are into every single pitch. They're singing, they're chanting, there's drums pounding, there's horns blowing, there's flags going. It's really just incredible. It's more like a college football game, an important college football game. And the enthusiasm of the crowd just blew me away. And I fell in love with Japanese baseball that night.
It's funny because you're saying that you're comparing it to college football. When I was there, I had a chance to see some high school baseball on TV. And the way they respond to high school baseball, I was always saying that that is analogous to college football here.
Absolutely. I mean, the two are intertwined with the cheering sections. So the cheering sections probably came first in high school and college, but they've really been adopted in the pro circuit for decades at this point.
Now, you write about this in your brand new book and the Japanese ballpark behind the scenes of Nippon Professional Baseball. Again, you've written several books about Japanese baseball. Was there anything particularly challenging about doing this one?
Yes. So this book is based on interviews with people who work in Nippon Professional Baseball, better known as NPB. And the idea for the book came when I was watching a game and I was watching a beer girl. Because as you probably know, in Japan, you do not go up to a stand to buy a beer. Instead, there's young ladies who are dressed in colorful costumes with kegs on their backs, who go up and down the stadium steps, and they'll serve you a draft beer at your seat. So I ordered a beer, and throughout this game, I'm noticing that this young woman is running up, everybody jogging up and down these steps over and over again, and how incredibly tiring this job must be. And I realized that I didn't know much about what happens behind the scenes in Japanese baseball. How do you put on a game? What are all the elements that are different from an American stadium? So I then had to reach out to people to interview, to ask the questions about, what's your job like and how does it differ from an American job? So the struggles of this book were finding those people and then interviewing them because there's a language barrier. I don't speak Japanese well enough to do an interview. So I started out with friends of friends. And talking to people who have jobs that interest me, such as people in the front office, a few former players, former manager, people who I could get in contact with pretty easily. And then I had to find people like in the marketing departments. I had to find a cheerleader, a beer girl, an umpire. And that was more difficult. So I did web searches looking for people in the different organizations. I tried to find Japanese who spoke English at least well enough to make an introduction to, and some of them actually gave the interview in English. But with most of my Japanese interviewees, we did the interviews in Japanese through an interpreter on Zoom, so I could have a face-to-face interview with them, and we can talk to each other, but there was a third person interpreting for us at the same time.
I'm curious, that third person, were they in Japan or were they with you?
Trevor Rachura actually lives in Japan. He is a English professor at one of the universities in Osaka. He is a big baseball fan, has written about Japanese baseball. So he knows Japanese baseball inside and out, probably better than I do even. And he did the interpretation for me for almost every interview.
So among the chapters I found most interesting were the interview with the beer girl, who explains, I can't even imagine how that would work in the United States. Also the cheerleader, the woman who is the cheerleader, and the problems that they face on, shall we say, a social level. Because being women in this sport and being amongst men, that presents its own challenges. Refresh my memory, were there any other women in the book, in this book?
Sure. I was lucky enough to interview Tomoko Namba, who's the owner of the Yokohama Bay Stars. So that was a real coup to get an interview with her. So she talked about what it was to be running the team from the top. I also interviewed a woman named Jenny Rothman, who is an American, another professor in Japan, as a fan. She's lived in Japan for 20 years and was able to explain the fan experience because being familiar with both America and Japan, she really had insights to compare and contrast them. I believe, I have a feeling there was at least one other woman I interviewed, cheerleader Jenny. Maybe that was it. Maybe it was only four.
The other person I found very interesting was the interpreter. Many years ago, I did an article for a language magazine where I interviewed a Japanese interpreter here in the States, working for a Major League Baseball team. Talk about a little bit about the challenges on both sides of the ocean for these people.
Right. Iwamoto-san, the interpreter, first started out with the Mets, and he was the interpreter for Shinjo when Shinjo played for the Mets. And now he is actually working for the Nippon Ham Fighters, where Shinjo is manager, although he's no longer an interpreter. Now he's in the front office. So he kind of came full circle, which is kind of fun.
Let me interrupt you for just one second. Now, Shinjo, and you point this out in the book, he was the first position player to be in the majors, and the interaction you have with an everyday player like that, is that different than a pitcher who now do the interpreters come out to the mound here to interpret? Like if the manager or a coach goes out to talk to the pitcher on the mound, I'm guessing he has to take the interpreter with him.
In both countries, the interpreter will go out to the mound or go to first base if for some reason there's a conference on first base with a runner.
Okay, so please continue.
So I think the difference is just to clarify, Shinjo was the first position player in the National League. I think
Oh, okay.
beats him by a few hours in the American League. But yeah, don't want anybody to be too upset if it's a Sabre group.
Stickler for details.
The difference is for the interpreter is, how should I say this? People expect different answers in the different cultures, both the managers and the media. So, for example, players have told me, and the interpreters have told me, there's a more honest exchange of ideas in the United States, really, in both to the manager and also to the media too. So when a player is sitting down with their manager and they're discussing an issue, there is expected in the United States to be a fair amount of honesty. This is how I feel. Okay, fine, but this is how I feel, and I'm the manager. A back and forth until they work out the problem or they reach an impasse, which doesn't usually happen. In Japan, the manager has more power, is more of an authority figure. A manager will mostly tell the players, this is the way it is. And the players really don't have much back and forth with the manager. They may have a complaint. that they may err, but that's not rare. Or if it is erred, it's done in a certain, very mild way. And it's understood by the manager that this is a complaint said in the proper way. So for the interpreter, so for Ken Iwamoto, who interpreted both for the Mets and for the Nippon Ham Fighters, his answers might differ to the same question. So if Shinjo has a complaint with Bobby Valentine, Iwamoto has to be pretty straightforward.
And
If
also, like you say, you mentioned the media. And I always wondered, the translations, are they mostly verbatim, or does the translator have to find a way to convey what he believes is the message in a way that the recipient, in this case, the media, will find it palatable, acceptable, etc.?
a good translator will get the feel of the message. He will interpret it in light of the culture that's receiving it. So, for example, in the book, there's an example where Shinjo said something very abrupt. Shinjo is actually known for a very abrupt, outgoing personality in Japan. He's really quite not the so-called traditional or stereotypical Japanese man. So Iwamoto had to reinterpret the answer to soften the answer, even in the United States media, so that no hard feelings were made with the player he was discussing. In Japan, there is a greater barrier between the media and the teams and the players. There's almost a wall. In the United States, much of the media works with the players and works with the team to get a message out, to create entertainment, and they can work together. And if you cross a player, my understanding is you might hear about it. The player may take you aside and tell you off. In Japan, the media doesn't get really close access to the players for the most part, and the team controls as much as possible of that access. So you're less likely to get a really honest answer into the Japanese media.
Well, let's talk about the culture for a minute. Do you think it's harder for a Japanese player to adjust to American baseball or vice versa?
It completely depends on the player's personality. There have been numerous Americans who've adapted very well to Japan, and numerous Americans who failed in Japan due to adaptations rather than baseball skills. And the same goes for players who came here. In both cultures, you have to be willing to try new things. You have to be willing to have an open mind and be able to say, okay, I'm in a foreign country. This is what they do here. I'll go along with it and not stick to the system that you're used to from your own country. And if you can do that, if you can keep an open mind, if you can adapt, you get a long way, I think.
Now let's expand on that. And what about a manager? Like you have Trey Hillman in this book, and they have to learn how to deal with Japanese players. Bobby
Right.
Valentine was very good at that. Trey Hillman has it's a very interesting chapter about his experiences.
Right. Trey tells this great story. He goes over there, and he was well prepped before he went over there to manage. But he comes into spring training, and he is watching the intensity his players practice in the spring training with. And he said, "Well, I expected this, but I didn't expect this level of intensity." And he decided that he thought his players were really practicing too hard, that they needed to back off a little bit, save some energy for the season, save some energy for the games, and just practice their skill level. So he reduced the intensity and, more importantly, the time of his practice, the length of his practices. And his players weren't happy with it. And eventually, one of the players came up to him and asked for a one-on-one meeting. I assume the interpreter was also there. And he was very open with Hillman. He said, "I'm so sorry, I understand what you're doing. And the team understands the reasons of why you are keeping our practice short. But I think they said something like, is we can't sleep at night. Our souls aren't happy. We feel we're not doing our jobs, basically, if we do not practice the way we were brought up to practice. If we do not really let it all out, we're not happy with the end of the day. So can we please go back to practicing harder?" And Hillman, smart man, willing to compromise, listened and said, "All right, if that's what the team wants, let's go back to your way of practicing." And then what he tried to do was just manage it a little bit better, a little bit more subtly.
Did you find any problems with the differences? Problems is not really a great word, but the differences between the way the teams are run. In Japan, it's more of a corporate, they're run by corporate entities rather than individual ball clubs who are managed or owned by multi-billionaires or whatnot. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So all the Japanese teams, except for one, are owned and run by big corporations that sell another product. The teams, for example, Yomiuri Newspaper runs a media company. Yakult Swallows runs a yogurt drink and other beverage companies. Nippon Ham Fighters, they sell ham and other meat products. Decades ago, the baseball teams were bought as really much advertising for their main products, for the main company. And it didn't matter whether the company, whether the team made a profit or not. Matter of fact, there was a statute, I think it's statute or decree, I'm not sure what the right legal term for it, passed in 1953 or 54 that said the Japanese companies may deduct all the losses of their baseball teams as advertising expenses. So once that was put in, many of the teams were quite happy with the loss as long as they got their message out about their product. Now, over time, that has changed. The Hanshin Tigers, the Yomiuri Giants have been making profits for a long time. And now, many, if not most of the other teams are also trying to make profits. Sports has grown a great deal, of course, in both countries. And the larger corporations realize that their baseball team can make a profit as well as being good advertising. So that's changing the way the team kind of looks at marketing, the way it looks at player development, and the way it looks at the acquisition of foreign players. For example, let me see. One of the things when I interviewed Tokyo Namba, the owner of the Yokohama Bay Stars, she ran, founded, and then runs a software company, and she thought this the same business model should apply to the Yokohama Bay Stars as applies to a bigger company, so she went out, and the Bay Stars were playing in a municipal stadium where all the proceeds from the beverages and the food, the concessions, went to the city of Yokohama. So the Bay Stars decided that they needed to acquire the stadium. And once they did, they were able to keep the profits from concessions, which allowed them to make a profit, which allowed them to put more money back into player development, which made the team, of course, better and better, allowed them to sell more tickets, allowed them to do more marketing, and bring in more money. It's the same in the United States. I mean, once the Phillies decided to spend money, they started winning and started bringing in a lot more money. So the Japanese teams, not all of them, but most of them, are now working under that model.
Is there, well, what's a turnaround like when it comes to ownership in Japan? It seems that there isn't as much as there would be in the United States.
There's very little. I can't give you that exact statistics, but I would say most of the teams have been owned by the same owner for at least 20 years, maybe 30, 40, 50 years. The Bay Stars have been bought recently by DeNA, this software company. The Rakuten Eagles are a new expansion team from the 19, I think what, 2012. And I'm trying to think of any new ownership since then, and I can't think of any.
You mentioned the marketing before. Well, one of the things I really enjoyed about being in Japan was being able to go to the Tokyo Dome where I got my hat. I mean, I always like to get a hat if there's a team in the vicinity. You can't go into a mall or a shopping center in Japan and just buy any old hat you want. Everything is very specific to the team. So talk about that, please.
That's right. Well, there's two reasons for one for that. Let's talk first about the cultural reasons, and then we'll talk about the marketing reasons. And I'm sure they're intertwined. But culturally, baseball gear is not a fashion statement or symbol in Japan. You do not see people walking around Tokyo wearing, unless they're kids, wearing Tokyo Giants gear. You wear gear to go to a game. So on game day, you'll see people wearing the local team's gear, usually when they're going to the ballpark. But on a non-game day, you just won't see it. You'll occasionally see college kids wearing US teams. You'll see that, but you won't see, for the most part, you don't see adults wearing baseball caps during the day. Sometimes.
I saw a fair amount of people wearing Dodger hats
Right.
when I was over there, which is perfectly understandable.
You'll see the Dodgers hats, you'll see the Yankees hats, but I bet you they were all young people. I bet you they were dressed in kind of an American style. Because, yeah, you see, so that's a style over there. People dress, just as they do here. There are different styles. And one style over there for younger people is the American style. So you'll see a t-shirt with writing on it, you'll see jeans, you'll see a baseball cap. And that's just a style some people dress at. It's not very widespread. So one of the reasons you don't find gear all over, like in a shopping mall, is people are wearing them to be fans at a game. So therefore you buy them at the game. You'll find there are some stores that will carry the local team stuff so that you can have it ready for the next game. But they're rare. And there is no shop that I'm aware of where that has a good selection of all the teams.
Were there any particular sub-professions in the game that you wanted to find someone to talk about and you couldn't?
Oh, that's a good question.
It seems pretty well covered by a lot
Yeah.
of different.
I'm going to say no to your exact question. What I did is I ran out of room. I was allowed 100,000 words, and I interviewed about 31, 32 people. And I had a list of I would say five more people or professions that I kind of wanted to get to, but my editor said, "No, you're already over budget in terms of words. Cut a few chapters and slim some of the chapters you have so you're under 100,000." So I had to stop before I interviewed, say, a groundskeeper. I didn't get to interview a labor leader from or a labor negotiator from either the player rep or from the league. I did get to interview the president of the Japan Hall of Fame, but that chapter had to be dropped because I was already over by a word limit. So there were a few things. I wanted to interview a concession seller other than the beer girl, but once again, I was over the limit.
So that must be difficult for a writer because this is your baby, and you want all this information in there. So the decision of who to cut totally and what to cut from the individual and still have it make the points that you want to make, that must be very difficult.
It is. I've done, this is my 10th or 11th book, depending on how you count them. And I've worked with University of Nebraska Press, I think, for five. So I have a good relationship with them and I kind of trust them. The editors know what they're doing and they'll tell you, all right, this chapter's dragging. And you want somebody who pick up the book in a bookstore, look at it, and say, oh, I'll take this home. And you want somebody who's bought it online to start reading it and finish the book. So, brevity is really important. So try not just to have stuff in there just to pad or because it might be kind of interesting. Try to really get to the meat of each interview. So I interviewed people for 1 to 2 hours each, and they come down to about 3,000 some words per interview. So I might start out with 15,000, 20,000 words. And we cut, 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 cut until we get to the points we really want to touch on.
And that's an important point. You are lucky enough to have a consistent publisher in University of Nebraska, and they certainly know their stuff. And I find that some publishers who aren't used to doing this kind of subject, UNP is known for putting out good books about baseball, whereas some others, just might be a one-off, and they might not have the personnel who can look at something and say, this is more important than this. I do find that a bit problematic when I'm reading something and find mistakes or overages. Say they could have done without this. But it sounds like you've been pretty happy and lucky with who you've been working with.
I've been very lucky. I mean, I think my first book, the Wally Onamine biography, was 150,000 words, the first draft.
Yikes.
And that down, yeah, yikes is right, right? Rob Taylor just got like halfway through and he called me up and said, I'm going to mark up the first three chapters in detail. And then I want you to go through the rest of the book and follow suit. And so I came back and I had a couple months to do that. And it really taught me a lot. There were some great stories that got cut, but Rob thought that they were a little bit tangential, and so it would slow down the narrative arc of the story, because that's really for a biography, for a narrative, which this new book is not, but for the other ones you need that narrative arc. So anything that gets in the way of the climax and then the conclusion really should be slimmed down.
Having written all these books on Japanese baseball, do you find you want to do something else baseball-wise?
I've thought about doing kind of a 19th century or dead ball. My previous career was as an archaeologist, focusing on colonial and 19th century America. So I actually have a fairly good background in Victorian American studies. And so I've thought about that, but I really love Japanese baseball. And so every time I think about, well, is it time for a change? I get another idea of a topic in Japanese baseball I want to explore. And that's how I find my topics. I don't sit down and say, oh, what will sell or anything like that. I'm doing my general reading and I find something that's like, wow, that's really cool. I don't know much about that. Let's go investigate that. And sometimes the study lasts a week and I say, okay, well, that's all there is to know about it, or that's not very interesting. I'm done. And sometimes it opens up, more questions and interesting topics. And I say, okay, I'm going to go explore this and I'm going to make this into a book if it works.
So how difficult is that? If you find something interesting in Japanese baseball, as you say, you're not fluent in Japanese, how hard is it to find the information in any language?
Sure. So there's certain topics I can't really write about. If I wanted to write, say, well, here's a book that I've been thinking about writing that I cannot. So there's two very great players in Japan, Sadahara Oh, the all-time home run king, and his teammate Shigeo Nagashima. Up until Ichiro and Ohtani, they were considered the greatest players in Japanese baseball history. And they were teammates, and they led the Tokyo Yomiuri Giants to five straight Japan Series titles. I'm sorry, I just said five, nine straight.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. And so I would like to explore their relationship together. It's been talked about in English previously, but I'd like to explore that further. I can't. There's tons written about that in Japanese, but I can't basically afford the translator. I can't afford the time to scan it all into ChatGPT, which I'm just beginning to play with, but does do translation. It's just beyond the scope of writing a book. So I have to find topics that I'm passionate about that I can also explore. So it usually involves having Americans, such as Wally Onamine, the first American to play in Japanese baseball after World War II, or the Babe Ruth tour of Japan, or Mashi Murakami, who came to the United States. All those books has such a strong English element that I could do 75% of the research in English. And then I have 25% only where I go to Japan, I copy sources, I hire a translator or an interpreter, and I go through the Japanese sources to get the different perspective, the Japanese perspective on the topic.
Now, you just brought up something else that's different than from when you first started writing. Now you have a resource like ChatGPT. Do you find that useful? Is it overstated what it can do? How do you work with that? Do you work with that often?
No, I don't yet. I'm just beginning to play with it. I have started using it now for translation of emails, which is great because if I have to send a quick email, such as, "Hey, the book's out. Would you like to have a copy? Where can I send it?" I would used to have to write that and then get somebody, a friend, to translate it for me. Now it takes me seconds and I can send it both in English and in Japanese so they can kind of, see both to make sure it came out right. So that has been a real time saver. What I need to do next is start experimenting with downloading Japanese text from books or newspapers into it so I can use that. And I haven't started doing that yet.
And finally, I can't leave this without asking, how spot on or not spot on was the movie Mr. Baseball?
Everybody asked that question. So Mr. Baseball, the story I have been told was that the one of the people involved, whether it be the director or the writer, I don't really know who, went to Japan prior to the filming to do some research. And he got in touch with the American ball players. And they took him out to dinner and they started telling him the stories about what really happened. And he said, "Really? Wow." And he rewrote the whole script. That is the story I have been told. So a lot of the silly incidences that happen in there are true. They are told by the American ball players and they got into the movie. Of course, the whole romance thing is completely unrealistic.
Yeah, that's
But yeah, the ball players still love it. And most of the ball players actually watch it before they go over, even to this day. It's a fun movie, and it will teach you some basics about Japanese baseball, especially as it was way back then. Was it 1990,
It was in the 90s,
1991,
yeah.
something around there, right?
Yeah.
Japanese
Frightening to think it's that old.
Yeah, it is. Japanese baseball has changed so much in those 30 years. It's com I wouldn't say I don't want to say completely different, but it's really a different ball game on the field now.
Well, it's a highly recommended movie, and this is a highly recommended book in the Japanese ballpark, Behind the Scenes of Nippon Professional Baseball. We've been talking with its author, Robert Fitz. Robert, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks so much, Ron.